This is Travis Garrison. Don't turn this with Travis Garrison of the Building City State Networks. Let's talk some Merlin Terp basketball on Tourney Time. They have a big game coming up this Saturday against UConn, a very good team. But what I think what the Terps need to do is just to come out and play how they did against Michigan State, play even harder, be more consistent. The defensive end, it all starts there. They're a great defensive team. If they can be able to hold their composure and hold the teams to less points, I think they have a good chance to make a run. You see, they had times when they beat big top teams. So it happened before. So, and it's tournament time. Anything can go down in tournament, you know, teams get hot and go on a run. All you need to do is win one game at a time, and you can go as far as possible. We've seen it done before. So anything can happen. I think anything can happen with the Terps this year in the tournament. They're in there now. So, you know, it's a clean slate. It's a new start. It's a fresh start. Our regular season is now over with. It just beat Michigan State in the tournament, you know, in the Big Ten tournament. So I think going into this tournament, I think they have a really good chance to make something happen if they go out and play like they can and like how we've seen them play before. But it starts on Saturday against UConn. I think if they go out there, they play hard defensively, be consistent on scoring and keeping the leads. You know, anything can happen. Anything can happen. And then, you know, obviously they win that game. They play the winner between Alabama and Iona. But right now, you know, they go out there, take care of UConn, and just go from there.
Got a special guest with me today, my big brother, Tony Massenburg. I appreciate you joining Go Terps with Travis Garrison on the Field of 68 Networks, man. It's been a while, bro, obviously with COVID. I know last time I saw you physically, it was at when we did the celebrating our ACC tournament. That was last February, I think it was.
Yeah, man. That's like maybe 2 years ago.
Nah, it was
COVID. It was COVID last year.
Wow, was it, man?
Yeah, that's like 2 years ago, bro.
Dang.
Yeah, it's been a minute, man. You're getting old, man.
Hey, bro. Yeah. Hey, man. Yeah, it's crazy, man. But it was always, like I said, always great catching up with you, man. You always, like I said, man, took me under your wing, man, and always looked out for me. So I definitely appreciate that, bro. And I appreciate you taking time to, you know, join me on my podcast, man. Thanks a lot.
Oh, man, it's my pleasure, bro.
Yeah, man. So, you know, man, a lot of fans, a lot of your fans, they want to hear what's going on with Tony Massenburg, man. I know a lot of people want to, you know, hear the experiences that you had, you know, especially there in Maryland. I want to hear it too, you know. I know we talked, man, but so what made you, I know you're from Virginia, man. What made you choose to come to go to Maryland?
Well, first of all, man, I'm from about 15 minutes outside of Petersburg, Virginia. Okay. You know, south of here, almost 3 hours south of here. So I'm a DMV guy, but they don't ever really count my part of Virginia as part of DMV. But we all obviously watch Maryland, you know, the whole ACC and all of that. So I was a huge ACC fan because that's the network, Raycon. We always saw all the games, Maryland, Carolina, Duke, everybody. And right. So for me, my high school coach is from North Carolina. Right.
Okay.
And where I grew up is about 20 minutes north of the North Carolina state line. So I'm real close to North Carolina, like I'm deep South Virginia. Right. And people that in my area are always Virginia Tech, UVA, UNC, like, you know, they're fans like that. And so for me, I actually grew up a Carolina fan until I was in like 10th grade. So I was a Carolina fan, and we ran Carolina's offense in high school, the whole thing. So my high school coach used to take us down to North Carolina, and I was actually at the practice when Michael Jordan broke his hand as a freshman. I don't expect you to remember that because, you know, you'd have been way too young. I don't even think you were born.
Boy.
But, that's how deep the Carolina connection went for me. And so I'm watching the ACC tournament. I believe it's my sophomore or junior year. And I see this high flying forward from the University of Maryland named Lynn Bias. And so I'm like, man, like this dude is incredible. He's got a jump shot. He got a 40-inch vertical. He dunking on people. He plays inside. He's tough. He's flashy. Everything that I wanted to be as a basketball player. And so I identified with him. And that identification with him started my love for the University of Maryland. And so I followed Maryland and watched them win the ACC tournament. And just the more I watched Len Bias, the more I was like, man, I want to play like that. And so by the time I'm a junior, now I've ascended, you know, in the Virginia high school rankings. And now I got schools recruiting me. And I go to five-star. And at this point, nobody knows this, but my mind was already made up. I wanted to go to Maryland. I had others, but you know, ton of other schools recruiting me, but I wanted to go to Maryland for one reason, to play 1 year with Len Bias. Cause you know, I knew if I was a freshman, he'd be a senior if he stayed in school, which he did. He ended up staying and coming back for his senior year. And so when Lefty Giselle approached me at five-star, I couldn't let the cat out the bag on how bad I wanted to go to Maryland.
But
when he approached me with the opportunity and said, you know, son, I like the way you play, son. I like the way you move out there. You know, you remind me of Buck Williams, son. You got the big old hands like Buck, son. I really like that. So to hear him say that and compare me to Buck Williams, man, it was a wrap after that. Wow, so man. I went ahead on and I did my, you know, you have your five visits, right? On my third visit to Maryland, my first one was South Carolina, second one was Wake Forest, my third one was to Maryland. After that, it was a wrap. I told my parents when we were leaving, going back down south, driving back to Virginia, I said my mind's made up. So from that point forward, man, you know, it was all about just getting up to Maryland, man. And I can remember being a 17-year-old, about 2-3 weeks after I graduated from high school, packed up my little car in Virginia, man, and drove up here to campus to be a part of the Summer Bridge program. At that time, they had a Summer Bridge program, which I don't know if they still have it, but it's basically to help college athletes get acclimated to campus before the semester starts. Give you some familiarity, how to get to class and stuff like that, and get familiar with the campus. Plus, you know, work out and play, you know, in the summer and all of that. So get a little bit of a head start. So that was it for me, man. I drove up here. No navigation, obviously, because you know, that didn't exist at that time.
Literally
following a map, you know, literally following a map and not scared at all, man. You know, 17, 3 years out of, you know, 3 weeks out of high school. I couldn't wait, you know, to get up here.
Right. Nah, man, that's dope, man. And I know you you play under Lefty when you first got there. And it's funny, man, because he recruited me, and he's at Georgia. he recruited me late, like he was late. I was like pretty much had my top five already. He calls my home phone, and he's like, "Hey, do you know who I am?" And I'm like, he said, "Yo, you know who I coached? Like, you know, talking about Len Bias. You know how Lefty is, man.
I just told you. I know how the speech went, man. I already know what you got."
And he was like, "Man, I said I already got my top five." He was like, "Man, do you know who I am? Like, very great guy, man. But yeah, how was that playing under Lefty and you know playing that 1 year with Len Bias, man?"
Man, it was awesome, man. It was for me a dream. I mean, one minute, you know, you're a country boy, man, from a small town in Virginia, you know, watching your idol and Len Bias, you know, do his thing in the ACC tournament. And then literally within the span of 4 months, you're standing next to him in the starting lineup, you know, on the jump ball. I'm jumping ball against the Duke Blue Devils on national television. So, and I remember when I stepped into the circle and I think it was Jay Billis that was jumping ball, maybe Danny Ferrer, who I can't remember for sure. Mm. Maybe it was Mark. I think it was Mark Allery. And I can remember just stepping into the circle and I had a moment like in a second where it's like, it was just a few months ago. I was sitting in my room watching these guys square off against the Duke Blue Devils. And now here I am in the starting lineup on a nationally televised game next to my idol, tipping, you know, at the jump ball against the biggest rival in the conference. I mean, it was a surreal moment for me as a freshman, man. And and to go through the season. I started, I think, maybe 7-8 games my freshman year. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I got to play and to play alongside Lynn. And you know, the hardest thing for me to do at that time, man, believe it or not, was to not be in awe of the guy. I mean, right. he was the dude, man, on so many levels, as a basketball player, as a big brother, as a dude that you just, he worked really hard. And that's what I think a lot of people underestimated, because they saw all the God-given ability that he had, right, and the talent. And they, right, were like, well, you know, he rolled out of bed with a 40-inch vertical. And like, right, they don't understand, like, it wasn't just about the athleticism. It was about the work ethic. And Lynn forced himself into a great player. He was raw when he came to Maryland, like a lot of freshmen are, like, right, I was. Right. And he refined his skills over the years. And by the time he was a junior, man, he was, you know, everybody knew he was the best player in the nation. So, right, to be alongside a guy that has that type of impact and has put the work in and basically has laid out a template for you as a player, right, to follow on the work ethic side, it's something that stuck with me for life, man, and literally, you know, drove me through my pro career.
Right. Yeah, man. Like, and that's just like, man, just to play with him, like you said, man, growing up, you know, watching him and then being able to play with him, man, I just know that was an incredible experience. And I know, like I said, you played under Lefty, man. Like, well, how was he as a coach? How was he as a coach, man?
Hey, man, he was a fiery individual. He's a fiery individual, man, and as competitive of a coach as they come. I mean, he did not like losing. And there were certain schools in Duke and Carolina that he absolutely detested losing to. So I remember probably our biggest moment was winning, giving the Tar Heels their first loss in the Dean Dome. The Dean Dome was only 2 years old my freshman years, and maybe three, but I think it was two. But it was a brand new state-of-the-art facility at that time. And they had not lost a single home game. And wow. So for us in 1986, we go down there, obviously led by Lynn Bias, and he goes down, man, and puts on a performance of a lifetime. You know, one that everybody's still talking about to this day. Mm-hmm. And to be a part of that game and to play alongside him, and then towards the end, watch him literally carry the team on his back, man, on both ends of the court, defense and offense, and just hit big shots and literally lift us to a victory against our rival and give them their first loss ever. You know, obviously goes down in the history books, but it also is a testament to his greatness, because he had a lot of great games, but he was unbelievable that night. And you know, there were a couple of games that I could say that he was unbelievable in, but you know, we won that game on top of him having a great game. So he was just a guy, man, that you just, you know, one of the toughest things as a teammate was not to, you know, be distracted by just watching him. Like, yo, you got to keep playing, because you just looked at him and you was like, okay, what's he going to do next? It didn't matter if he got double teamed. He just rise up over everybody, man, and just, you know, knock it down. And if they had a 3-point line at that time, Travis, that dude's points per game would have been, he averaged 25, almost 26 points a game his senior year. And he was shooting 3-pointers from the top of the key and from the corners. But there was no 3-point line. But if they had one at that time, that average would have been like closer to like 28, 29. I mean, he was incredible, man. And all the basketball that I played, from high school to camps, to college, to summer leagues, to pro leagues, to pro teams, I have never seen anybody with that total package of skills. I see guys that can bounce, but they can't shoot like him. Right, I see guys that can shoot, but they can't bounce like him. I see guys that can shoot a little bit and bounce a little bit, but they weren't as strong as him, couldn't play inside the way that he could play inside. So, I mean, to me, if he had lived and been what we thought he could have been in Boston, he would have been that rival, that unparalleled rival that Michael Jordan would have had. And I really think that if Lenny had an opportunity to play in the NBA where he should have been, he would have changed the game sooner, because we would have seen more forwards extending the range out to the three-point line, and that would have become a template at that time back in the 80s quicker than it took, you know, up until now where you're starting to see big guys shoot jump shots.
Man.
You had a little bit of that, man. You had some of that. You were a dude that stretched the floor. But it would have happened sooner than you done it. Yeah.
Right. Man, and I remember Dave Dickerson, man. I think it was Dave. He gave me a tape of that game you're talking about against North Carolina. My brother got it somewhere. My brother took it, man. He got it somewhere, but it was a legendary tip. I watched that game because I think Dave, Coach Dickerson wanted me to check it out. And I was interested. I think I saw it in his office. I said, man, let me see that. And just to watch it, like you said, man, obviously I wasn't even watching basketball. I wasn't even born around that time.
I don't think you weren't born.
Yeah. But just to watch it as the older, just to see, like you said, man, his greatness at that, during that time back then, man, it was, I'm watching the games. I'm like, and I'm watching highlights and I'm like, man, that's what taking off.
Incredible.
Man, taking off from outside the paint, man, backwards. I'm like, man, like, it was, like you said, man, it was incredible, man, just to watch it, you know. Then, like you said, man, the play alongside of that, man, I can only imagine.
Man, definitely influenced me. I spent my whole career trying to be something like that dude. I knew I wasn't going to be exactly like him, but I wanted to be something like him, man. It was the work ethic, bro. I mean, he was great. Don't get me wrong. He was talented and all of that, but I'm telling you, he put the real work in behind the scenes. A lot of people don't know that.
Man, and I'm glad you shared that, because like you said, man, a lot of people, a lot of fans just see, all they see is the games and the highlights, and they don't see the stuff that goes in the gym, or, you know, after hours and in practice, at the end of practice and things like that. Yep. They don't understand it, or they don't see it. So for you to share that, man, I'm pretty sure it's news to a lot of other people that may not have known that about him. Yep. So during your time at Maryland, man, you played for three different coaches, man. How was that, man? Just get 4 years in college. You get four years in college, so every year is a new transition, is new coaches, new philosophy. How was that experience, and what was that like?
You know what? I look back on it, and it was definitely, after, you know, Lenny died, clearly all the stuff that happened, the fallout and everything, and the, you know, all the shrapnel of criticism that came towards us as players and the program and the university, that was tough to deal with. But when I look back on the experience, it really prepared me for what I would deal with as a pro. And I didn't know that I would be a pro at that time, you know, from my sophomore year. I kind of had a breakout year in my sophomore year. And, you know, Bob Wade comes in and, you know, like any other coach, man, you know, he wants to bring in guys that, you know, that he recruited. And he wants to build a team, you know, with his guys. And so he comes in 1986. And by 1987, the 1987-88 season, we had a roster of guys that featured seven McDonald's All-Americans, you know, a couple of which that he brought in and a couple that were already there. And I wasn't one of them, but I was in the starting lineup because I made a huge leap. I sat out 1 year after all this stuff happened. And so I didn't play the 86-87 season. I came back in 87-88. And basically I came back a new and improved version of myself. That whole year that I took off was basically dedicated to Lynn Bias. And I made a concerted effort to work myself into the best version that I could be. And I grew an inch, I gained 15, 16 pounds. So when I came back, you know, I was the guy that you worked out with in the summertime. I was, you know, I checked into Maryland, man, as a 6'8", 215-pound freshman. And my sophomore year, you know, the next time the ACC saw me, I was 6'9", about 233 pounds. So, and my game had, you know, obviously gotten a lot better because I had worked on it. And so from that point, I was able to crack the starting lineup at a time when, you know, Bob Wade hadn't projected me to be a starter. But I was so dominant in practice to where he could not ignore what I was doing. And so I worked my way into the starting lineup amongst all that talent and that team. And nobody talks about this at Maryland because, you know, nobody really talks about Bob Wade. But that team, that 87-88 team, we made it to the second round of the NCAAs. And when you consider the fact that Len Bias died, you know, June 19th, 1986, and we then fell into, you know, what would be considered the worst tragedy in the history of college basketball. We went from that in 1986 to being in the NCAAs in 1988, you know, in 1987-88 season. And so that was a sign that the program was on its way back. Then there was some things that happened from a violation standpoint that ultimately caused Bob Wade's job. Now, a lot of people, you know, have their opinion on that because, you know, he got cited for violations like, you know, giving players rides to classes. You know, I mean, when you consider some of the stuff that we have seen in the last 4 years with coaches literally going to jail for some of the things that have happened, with head coaches claiming that they didn't know what was going on and the guys beneath them, that system coaches, you know, ended up going to jail or possibly being prosecuted. And then the coaches move on and go to coach another university after small suspension, and Bob Wade basically gets banned for life. It's, you know, the hypocrisy is crazy when you think about it and the modern era. So, you know, Bob Wade exits in 89 and then in comes Gary. And so for me, I'm like, okay, basically here we go again. It's on my senior year. And, you know, if you're Gary, I'm your senior, your only returning, you know, starting senior. And, you know, I'm almost a throw in, you know, to the mix, because clearly, you know, Gary's thinking about the future of the program. So, you know, he wants to build his program, but he understands he has something pretty good there with, you know, with the team that he inherited, because, you know, let's be honest, he inherited me, Walt Williams, Gerard Mustaf. I mean, you know, three pros, Evers Burns, you know, who was also a freshman on that team and went on to, you know, to get a year with the Sacramento Kings. So you got four guys, you know, who were going to have some NBA experience. So he had something to work with. But again, we were still coming out of and dealing with sanctions and all this other stuff. Right. So for me, you know, the carousel of coaches in different systems, like you said, it just prepared me to play on, you know, the 12 teams that I would go on to play for in the NBA. And it set me up to a point where mentally my whole thing was, if I get in a game, I'm going to make a dent in that stat sheet. If I get in, I'm going to be productive. I don't care if it's 5 minutes or 10 minutes. I'm going to make something happen when I get out there, because I can't afford to do anything else other than be productive. Right. That was my mentality at Maryland because of everything that we had to deal with and playing for me, playing for three different coaches. Right. And once I got to the pros, you know, I was a second round pick. I wasn't a first round pick. So I had to make my team at that time. You know, it wasn't guaranteed, you know, 5 or 6 years and Nike deals and McDonald's and endorsements and all of that. It was, you have to show us that you can play on this level. And so I did that, and I played my 2 years in the NBA. I got released and I ended up going to Europe, and I adapted that same mentality in Europe. I ended up in Spain, and I adapted that same mentality where this is not the end of me, like it wasn't the end of me at Maryland, but is this time for me to work on my game and improve? And so I actually went to Europe, and I used Europe to improve my game to a point where now when the NBA sees me again, they won't be able to say no. And I made the All-Star team. I was top five in Europe, all Europe. We were in the European Cup Championship. We won the Spanish League. We were one of the best teams in all of Europe. And because of that, I got voted to the All-Star game, which is where the Los Angeles Clippers saw me play. And at the end of that season, they offered me a 2-year contract to come back to the NBA. So I went back to the Clippers in 94-95 season, and played another 12 years in the NBA, and eventually retired with the San Antonio Spurs.
And I saw that, man, and that's what I was going to get to, like, in regards to, so you go from, like you said, your sophomore year, not even thinking about the NBA, and then you end up getting drafted. Like, what was that experience like? And like you said, I mean, I can just only imagine, man, just putting that work in and then you reaping the benefits of all the hard work you put in. So what was that experience like? And Let's talk about that for right now.
Well, okay, let me put it like this. I was all ACC a couple of times, my junior, senior year, all ACC tournament or whatever. And at that time, the ACC was loaded with first round draft picks. I mean, loaded top to bottom. And a lot of these guys, you know, I was going through them, right? And I had better, you know, me and Dale Davis were the only two guys my senior years to even average a double-double. And, you know, his double-double was like, you know, 11 rebounds and like 10 points. And my double-double was like, you know, 10 rebounds, like 18, 19 points a game. And so I'm looking at these other guys who will go on to be first-round picks. And I'm like, okay, this guy's going in the first round. And, you know, I give him the business, but like, why do the pro scouts think he's better than me? So when I'm sitting there draft night, and I know where I'm projected late first at the best, possibly early second. And I end up going in kind of the middle of the second round. And so I was happy to get drafted because I was worried that I wouldn't, just based on the stigma that was still attached to Maryland players at that time. And it most certainly hurt my draft status because, again, we were still dealing with the after effects of the Lynn Bias situation and people questioning, you know, the character of Maryland guys, because that's how the media and some people in the public eye had, you know, made us out to be a group of thugs, a group of guys that just weren't good guys. And nobody even knew who we were. And so as people. And so I understood that. And so my whole thing was, if I get drafted, I don't care where I get drafted, I'm going to make that team. And so when the San Antonio Spurs picked me as a 43rd draft and 43rd pick in the second round, my whole mentality was, I'm going to go there and I'm going to prove to them that I'm worthy of being, you know, in the league and making a team. Larry Brown was the head coach at that time. Greg Popovich was an assistant. R.C. Buford was an assistant. He was Larry Brown's assistant. He was Larry Brown's assistant actually at Kansas. And so I know the story of the San Antonio Spurs and the ascension of that organization literally from the bottom, from the top up. They were good, very good team when I went there because they had just, they were in the Western Conference Finals. And so my vets were guys like Terry Cummings, David Robinson, Rod Strickland was one of my teammates, Sean Elliott. We eventually got the original big dog, Antoine Carr, Sidney Green, some of these other guys. And so I learned the pro game from these guys, and I learned how to play in the post as a pro from practicing against these guys every day. And so for me, man, when you say, what was it like? You know, it was a real learning experience, and it was a lot like my freshman year. But the difference was I was getting paid to play, and my career and my life sort of depended on it. So, you know what it's like when you go from playing on a scholarship to, okay, now I'm getting paid to play. But the difference is, this is how I put food on the table. So if this doesn't work out, now we got a problem. So I went there with an all-out mentality that I'm going to be the best that I can be. And again, I still had some things I had to work on. I improved in those things when I was in Europe, and then I came back. And as I said, I played another 12 years or so, and that was it, you know, for me. It was a real learning experience from top to bottom. And that's why I always say, everything that I learned at Maryland really prepared me to play at the next level.
And I can imagine. I kind of want to go back to that for a second, man, because, you know, obviously me playing at Maryland, me being like an athlete, but also a human being at the same time. And during that time when everything was happening, and like you're saying, everybody, and it was a big story. So they're looking at the players, and now you're getting characterized by people that don't even know you, like you said, fans. The outside world, they don't really understand or comprehend everything that we have to deal with. Then, let alone what you guys were going through during that time. But you guys are still young. You're young kids. You're young men. You don't understand, especially during that time. You don't understand like real life at the time. You're in college, you're playing the sport, you know what you love, but people look at athletes in a different light. It's they don't understand everything that entails being a student athlete, you know, school and have to go to practice and perform and things like that. So during that time and being characterized, I mean, I've been there and I kind of know that feeling, but I can only imagine what you guys were going through at that time with everything that was going on. Like, how did it make you feel, man? Like, I can imagine, but I just want to hear from you. Like, how did it make you feel as a man? And then people not knowing you and judging you and that don't even know you.
Well, for me, man, I had my mom and dad to lean on. And so when somebody attaches a false stigma to your name, that's always painful. You know, when your character is being questioned and when people are saying foul things about you and all your teammates without even knowing you, when adults are looking at you like you are a bad guy or a bad influence, you know, that's hard because, you know, it wasn't just people on the outside. It was people at Maryland. It were people in the athletic department who had basically turned on us. You know, a lot of people don't remember, but, you know, when the Len Bias situation happened, you know, there were people within the program were considering disbanding the basketball program. Just completely like, okay, we're not going to even have a basketball team here at this point. Like there was talk of that. And so for us, particularly our freshman year, our guys as freshmen, I mean, we just were like, you know, what are we going to do other than stick together? Because, you know, we had a couple of guys transfer, but the thinking for the majority of my freshman class was, you know, we're going to stick together and we're going to do whatever it takes to get through this, because if we don't, if we choose to go somewhere else, this is still going to follow us no matter where we go.
Right.
And so if it's going to follow us, you know, then we might as well stay here and band together as brothers and understand that no matter what goes on, we stay with one another and we have each other's back. Nobody understands what it's like to be us right now. And if you go to another campus, you transfer to another campus, then it's just going to be you, that one guy. And everybody's going to be like, oh, yeah, that's that Maryland guy right there. We already know what he's about. We heard about y'all kind of thing. We don't want to deal with that. Yeah. So we, you know, the majority of us stayed and we chose to stay because of our love for Maryland. And because at the end of the day, we felt like we could get through it better together than apart.
Yeah, man. And like you said, man, people, the outside, like that's a lot of times, I know even just playing the game, a lot of times, you know, especially if you lose, you know, the man, people are killing you, all the fans and you know, newspapers, everything, everybody's killing you. But and we came with the understanding of, man, you know what, it's just us in here. Whoever, these guys in the locker room, that's all that matters. Let's just focus on us. Let's not like entertain the outside world, people that don't really know us or know what we go through. Let's stick, and like you said, just banding together as the brotherhood. So I definitely get that, but I also know, man, like playing, like you said, playing for 12 different NBA teams, man. Like, first of all, playing the NBA, period, man, is an incredible experience, and then playing with other great players, especially back in those days in that era, and you went through it, man. You from the fifteen years
I played. Yeah,
man. So you seen the transition from different eras. So
yeah,
just kind of like walk me through that a little bit, like just that experience, man. Just seeing all these great players and how the game transitioned over time into, you know, what, the early 2000s.
Mid 2000s actually, late 2000s. Mm. My last time I walked off of the NBA floor, my last game with an NBA uniform was a Wizards uniform, and I was 40 years old. At that point, I was in Wizards training camp as a 40-year-old. And I had missed 2 years prior to that because of a car accident where I broke my ankle after, about 2 months after winning the championship with the Spurs.
I remember that.
2005. And I didn't show up on a basketball court again because at that time, if you were, first of all, let me take you back a little bit. By the time I was 33, people were already asking me, so you going to retire next year? And I'm like, what? What? Why would I do that? Did you just not see me out there putting it on their head just now? Like, well, ain't nothing wrong with me. Like, why would I do that? Yeah, you know, I'm still productive. So, and it's crazy because for me, you know, I know that for most guys, their prime years are in their 20s, right? Especially as basketball players. You know, your prime is usually somewhere in your mid-20s. But for me, I said this consistently, and I think statistically is probably, you know, I can verify it. My prime was actually from about 32 to 35. You know, from age 32 to 35, I can honestly say my game was more well-rounded. My jump shot was better. My inside game was more proficient. I was probably the strongest I had ever been because, like, at that point, then you got the what they call the old man strength, the grown man body. You come out of your 20s and, like, now you're really settled into who you are. Right. And from that point, I didn't lose anything bounce-wise. I never did experience a drop in my vertical. I never, even up until 37, I never experienced a drop. Now, I will admit, by the time I got to San Antonio as a 37-year-old, I didn't jump as often. If I'm going to say something, I'd say my second jump wasn't as good as it used to be as I got older. But I still had, you know, I could still get my, you know, considerable part of my wrist over the box, which was, you know, pretty good for a dude at 6'9". Right, so I could block shots still and I could rebound and you know, my jump shot was the best it had ever been because you know this, as you get older, your jump shot actually gets better as you continue to work on it. And so for me, you know, coming into the league in 1990, it was all about the big man. You know, I had David Robinson, who was, you know, one of the best big men in the league, Hakeem Olajuwon, you know, Patrick Ewing, you know, these were the guys that I had to guard. And you know, as a guy that played power forward and center. And so I watched, you know, 90s old school beat you up basketball, you know, Karl Malone, you know, those type of dudes, you know, then it, you get into like later in the like mid 90s and late 90s, you start to see the Tim Duncans and the Vin Bakers and the Chris Webbers. And so you see the game sort of expanding a little bit. So now you're starting to see more impactful plays from forwards and it's still about the big man. But because, you know, there are only so many great dominant big men, it really started to get about, you know, forwards, guys like Rasheed Wallace. You know, these were some of my toughest covers. And by the time I get to like 2003, when I'm with the Sacramento Kings, now I see this dude who's a rookie and playing his first NBA game. And he's the first pick in the draft. And it's some dude named LeBron James, right? That everybody's been talking about. Yeah. So I'm like, this, you know, every time I turn around, somebody's talking about this LeBron dude, LeBron. And I saw him in high school and I'm like, ah, you know, yeah, you know, he looks good or whatever, but you know, nothing like the real eye test, right? When you lay eyes on a dude, because you know, the hype machine can exaggerate, you know, a dude's size, you know, they be talking about the dude's 6'8", he's 240 pounds as a high schooler. And then you see the dude and he's like 6'6", you know what I mean? It's like, you know, whatever. Yeah, so I'm like, all right, let me see what this dude is. So I'm playing for the Sacramento Kings, and I see this dude. And within the first four or five plays, I'm sitting there on the bench like this. Like, wow, I have never seen this in my life. A dude who is almost the same size as I was like a little over 250 at that time, but I'm 37 years old. I was 36 at that time. But this dude is 18 years old. He's 6'8". He's 240 pounds. And he's literally the fastest guy in the gym. And he's one of the fastest guys I had ever seen at that size. I had never seen anybody with that type of quickness and that type of speed in the open court. And he could handle the ball. And he dropped dimes like magic. So I'm sitting here looking at a 6'8 guy with Michael Jordan type athleticism. And passing the ball like Magic Johnson. And I'm saying to myself, and I told, I'm not sure, I think it was Doug Christie at the time who came out of the game, and we were sitting on the bench at some point beside each other. And I told him, I said, I think we're looking at the future, bro. I think we're seeing the future. I said, because if these are the type of guys now, and by the way, in that same draft class was Carmelo Anthony,
Right.
And we hadn't really, we had seen something similar to Melo, like the big small forward that could post up and could also shoot threes. We had seen a little bit of that along the way, but we hadn't seen anything like this LeBron James kid. And so we were just sitting there nodding his head, and Doug had to guard it. And Doug said, man, his first step is unbelievable. He's like, man, he's like, you literally got to try to anticipate. He's like, I never had to guard a guy that was that much bigger than me that could beat me off the dribble. And I watched him, and I played in that game, and I was just, you know, I was amazed that this dude was 18 years old and had the physical gifts and the IQ to be a great playmaker already. And so for me, I saw the transition from the big man to the game expanding with versatile forwards, power forwards that could shoot threes, Kevin Garnett, you know, type dudes, 6'11", you know, dudes that could do it all, not just like play with their back to the basket, to seeing 6'8", 6'9", guys now at the guard spots and running the point like Magic and playing like, you know, two guards. Right. So when you look at that and then, you know, you fast forward to 07, 08, where I'm basically, you know, playing with guys now as a 40-year-old with the Wizards in training camp, I'm playing with guys that are young enough to be my son. So I've seen the game change, and I thought it changed for the better, because the one thing I can say, a lot of people don't like this new era, but I love this new era. And the reason why I love it is because when I played, you had to have a position. And I watched a lot of good dudes who were tweeners not be able to make it, not because they couldn't play, but because they didn't have a position. And when the pro scouts will look at you and say you don't have a position, that means you can't guard certain positions. Like you may be a three on offense, but you're a two on defense because you're not really big enough to be a three because you can't guard threes. But you got some perimeter skills, but you don't handle the ball or shoot quite good enough to be a two guard. You know? Whereas today's game, it's like, okay, it's gone positionless. A Draymond Green can flourish in this league. And I take no disrespect to Draymond Green whatsoever. I love how Draymond plays. But I've always said that if Draymond had played in my era, he would have struggled because he would have been considered a tweener. He would have been considered a post player who was not nearly big enough and strong enough to contend with guys like me and Karl Malone and Jim Duncan. But at the same time, he wouldn't have had enough offensively to be able to play the small forward with the type of guys that were playing small forward at that time. Reggie Miller, you know, MJ would sometimes play the three. You know, it was a different animal in the 90s, you know. So that's the transition that I've seen that I actually like. And let me say this too. It gives the little guy who would have been considered too little if your name, unless your name wasn't Muggsy Bogues, but outside of him and Earl Boykins maybe, you know, Spud Webb, a couple of those guys, but now you see a place for the little guy because if you can play, you can play. You can run the point as a little guy. It's not no such thing as being too small or you like to shoot too much. Now it's all about the skills, and regardless of your size, there is a team out there for you.
And like you said, man, just like you said, because I remember even going, I think even around my time, the tweener, like, are you a tweener? Like, was it a four? Is it five?
Four? Is it three?
So, like you said, then the tween. But now, because you got the stretch fours, now you're talking about the stretch now, you know. But like you
stretch
said,
fours and fives.
Exactly. So, and I definitely remember, like, I definitely remember when you went in a chip with the Spurs, man. What was that like? Winning the NBA, you're NBA champion. You know what I mean?
Well, that was my crowning moment, man. You know, a lot of people don't know. You know, I wore the number 34 I could only wear it for two seasons of my career because I was only on two teams where the number was available. But when I first got in the NBA, when San Antonio drafted me, the first thing I did was try to look up, you know, who had number 34 for San Antonio, because if nobody had it, that was going to be the number that I was going to wear as a tribute to Len Bias, because he was my favorite player. And part of the reason why I wore 44, two reasons, because number one, I had a cousin who was a great football player in high school. And he was the first one to put the Massenburg name on the map in Virginia. He ended up getting a scholarship to VMI, and so I was always inspired by the number 44. But my whole thing was, when I got to the league, if I couldn't wear number 34, I wanted to wear number 44. Well, when I got to San Antonio, I couldn't wear either one because the Iceman was number 44. Right. So I most definitely wasn't going to get that jersey. So right. I ended up wearing 45 my freshman, my rookie year. But most of the places that I played, I wore the number 44. And when I got the opportunity to wear 34 in Sacramento, and I got the opportunity to wear 34 when I went back to San Antonio in 2004, for the 2004-2005 season, I wore that number thinking about Len Bias. And so in my mind, that's always been my number. It's right. just that I couldn't always get it on, you know, the teams that I played on. So for me to stand there, you know, and be a part of a championship team and know that I helped us get to that point. I didn't play a lot in the playoffs, but I played a lot during the regular season because right. Tim was dealing with a knee injury and, you know, my number would get called. I'd started a couple of games. Played well when I started, and I was 37 years old. And so at that point, you know, people were still surprised that I was able to do the stuff that I could do. So when I stood there on a championship podium with the confetti coming down and I got the 34 on my chest and I got my family and everything else, it was a surreal moment for me because it was everything that I had worked for as a pro for 15 years. You know, it took me 15 years to win an NBA title, and I won that title wearing my idol's number. And you know, I got all the pictures and videos and all of that stuff. Mm. And for me, man, I remember saying to myself, like, you know, wow, like this is that moment that I've coveted, you know, my entire career. And I get to do it, you know, wearing the number 34 and being remembered as a champion. And, you know, that was really a defining moment for me. And I was just looking forward to, you know, to extending my career. But as fate would have it, I was getting to it, like I said, a car accident 2 months later that broke my left ankle. And I had to rehab for, you know, about almost a year, a little over a year. And at that time, you know, when you're talking to NBA teams and now you're, you know, 38, 39, you know, they didn't believe that you could still play at that point. Right. And right. they didn't believe in any guy being, you know, I was already beyond the threshold of what they thought, you know, a guy could do, you know, as far right. as being productive at that age. And right. so without my name being Michael Jordan, because he was the only one at that time, yeah. you know, that people had actually seen the last, you know, guy over 40 or 40 right. playing, still playing. So teams didn't believe in me. And then I stayed at it. I kept working out, and I'm going down to the arena, and I'm playing with the Washington Wizards in the summertime with Antoine and Karan and all these guys, and I'm killing them, right? Yeah. You know, I'm playing well, and yeah. Ernie is watching, and the general manager at the time, Ernie right. Grunfeld, is watching, and so he calls me in, calls me after we finished playing. He say, "Listen, we got one more spot." He said, "Would you like to come to training camp?" And I was like, "Would I?" You know, you know, in right. my mind. In my mind, and it wasn't so much, and he also explained to me at that time that they were over the salary cap and that they probably weren't going to be able to keep me because my salary at that time would have put them over. As a veteran player, my salary would have put them over the cap, and Ed Poland was not committed. Ed Poland was not committed to going over the cap at that time. Right. And so he said, you know, we probably won't be able to keep you, but, you know, you're playing, you clearly are, you know, you haven't lost anything. You're playing well. We just want to bring you in and you know, give you an opportunity. And maybe another team sees you and wants right. to give you a chance. And I was like, yeah. And in my mind, Travis, I did not want to end my career on a car accident. Right. I didn't want to sit at home and feel like the car accident took my career away from me. Right. So my mind was made up that I'm going to physically get back to where I was. And if they say no, they say no, but they right. won't say no because I physically can't do it anymore. I'm not the same right. guy. So I ended up with three screws in my ankle and, you know, clearly doing what I had to do to get back. And I did get back. I got my, you know, I got my bounce back, you know, I was playing well, but again, you know, the situation didn't work out from a, you know, from a salary cap standpoint and, right. and people just did not covet 40-year-olds at that time.
Right. Right.
And man, I know, because I think we talked a couple of times because you was on campus. I think it might have been right when you had your car accident. And I know y'all just won the championship with the Spurs. I know we talked a few times back then. And you came to the gym and you worked me out. You and Walt, remember that? Like it was yesterday. Yeah, I came in to work me out, man. At the rec center to help me out.
I remember.
As big brothers. So, and I always hit you about advice because you was one of the people I looked at like, I want to have that type of career because the way you took care of yourself, you know, the way you took care of your body and you stayed in the league. You stayed in the league. And like you said, at that age. So it's something like you don't see a lot of that. So something has to be going well. Like either you're putting that work in and you taking care of yourself. So you were the one I always looked at. And then I know Coach Williams would always mention you. You still was in the league. You stayed in the league for 15 years. Like, a lot of people don't do that. It's not like a thing. Like, oh, that's just normal. No, like, especially at your age. So you was always one of those people I always looked at. And I was like, man, I'm trying to be like that. I'm trying to stay in the league. And I remember you used to tell me, like, well, this is what you got to do. You got to take care of your body. You know, got to work out. And that's some of the things. That's a lot of things you did, man. And, man, like I said, man, I always appreciated your advice. And every time we got to talk and every time you came on campus or every time I saw you, man, you always took me under your wing, man. They always gave me
advice, man.
Anything I ever needed, man, you was always
whatever like, you needed, bro.
Just call me. So, man, I always appreciated that, man. I know now that y'all have, you and Walt, y'all have a book out. What was, tell me a little bit about the book.
Well, the book is, hold on for a second here. Get your copies. The book is on, you probably see the posters behind me, but the book's called Lessons from Lenny. And basically this is about the positive influence that Len Bias had on Walt and I. A lot of people don't know that Walt was a huge Len Bias fan and basically came to the University of Maryland because of his love for Len Bias. Now, clearly Walt didn't play with Len Bias. He was a 16-year-old kid in PG County when he heard about his death. And he was devastated. And he talks about that in the book. But he also talks about the inspiration that he was to him and the reason why he came to Maryland, and not just came to Maryland, but stayed at Maryland when the program went on sanctions when Bob Wade left. And so his love for Maryland, his love for the university, his love for Len Bias is something that him and I always had in common. And, you know, we talked about some of these things during the time that he was at Maryland and we were teammates for 2 years. And so, you know, he would ask me questions, you know, about Len and what it was like, you know, like what you were saying, you know, what was it like playing with him and you know, what did you learn and you know, that kind of stuff. And, you know, the book's called Lessons from Lenny because the lessons that I learned, I passed on to him. And the lessons that he learned, he passed on to the guys behind him, Johnny Rose and Dwayne Simpkins, X-Ray Hip and, you know, Keith Booth, Joe Smith, you know, all of these guys are guys who love Len Bias and they love the University of Maryland. And so for us as guys who were influenced by him, Walt and I made a commitment to doing whatever we could as pros to come back and tutor the young guys at Maryland and not just talk to them, but get them out on the court and play with them. You know, he and I were really assembling some of the best run, some of the best basketball games on the East Coast up on University of Maryland's campus. You know, we would, in the summertime, we would have anywhere from 10 to 15 NBA guys in the gym and mixed in with the Maryland players. And so, you know, we would have days where, you know, we'd have two courts going because if you lost a game, you know, you may not get back on the main court for, you know, 6 or 7 games. You know, and depending on what part of the day that you lost, you might not get back on at all.
Right.
You know, it was competitive. But the one thing that we always made sure of, we had days where we would mix the Maryland guys in with pros. Mm-hmm. And then we have days where we make them play together and just play against us. Because we felt like if these guys are playing against pros, then they're going to improve. They can get better playing against each other. But they're going to improve more by playing against people that are better than them. That's how you improve. And so we did a combination of both. We mixed them in, let them play together, and then we split them up, put them on our teams and let them go, you know, back and forth against other guys. And we did that for roughly 10 years, you know, out of our career. And it, you know, it came to, you know, we saw the fruits of our labor in 2002 with that team that, that won a championship. And, you know, the story that I also tell about that is that that championship, NCAA championship, was played in Atlanta in 2002. I was playing for the Memphis Grizzlies at that time. And so I was in Memphis, and we happened to have a day off on the night of the championship. And so I flew from Memphis, short flight from Memphis to Atlanta, just to go to the basketball game. And for me to stand there alongside Dave Dickerson, who was on the staff at that time and one of my teammates, we stood there, man. And I remember embracing him and us saying, you know, this was for Lenny. You know, Lenny's smiling down on us right now. Again, confetti coming down. And every guy on that team at that time, Lonnie Baxter, Chris Wilcox, you know, Steve Blake, all of these guys, Juan Dixon, all of these guys were guys that Walt and I had worked with directly the summer prior, you know, to that. And so for us, we felt a sense of connection, not just as Maryland alumni, but the fact that we worked hand in hand with this group of guys, and this was the result. And it was everything that we had hoped to hoped it would be. And Walt wasn't able to be there because I think he was actually on the West Coast at that time.
Right.
But I was able to be there. And it was a moment, man, that, again, much like me winning the championship later, 3 years later, it was the most awesome feeling to stand there and see Gary win his first championship and the University of Maryland win that first.
Right. Nah, man, Man, that's incredible, man. Like you said, man, just to experience two championships, like I said, just to be at the one at Maryland, the first ever championship,
yeah.
Like you've been a former Terp and seeing the whole, how the whole program went and transitioned to seeing that, like you said, the fruit of your labor, and then to seeing another fruit of your labor to actually get that NBA championship, man. It's like,
yeah,
man,
it's a dream come true, bro.
Exactly, man. And guys, and I tell guys all the time, especially the younger athletes, man, ask these questions, especially like if I'm talking to a group of athletes, any questions you have, ask, and because like I'm pretty sure you the same way, you love to share that knowledge. But people have to ask the question. You know
they
what I mean?
They
have to ask the question. So where can they get the book from? Where can they get the book at?
The book's available anywhere books are sold. You can get special autographed copies through our website, lessonsfromlenny.com. Those books are, they come directly from us, and every one of those books are autographed by Walt and I. So they're different. You can't get the autographed versions anywhere else other than our website, but they are, the book is available anywhere books are sold. So, you know, definitely a great read. We've gotten great responses back from it, particularly from people who remember Lenny and Walt and I being at Maryland, and more importantly, for people who don't know anything about Maryland basketball, I think it's a great story because it doesn't just talk about basketball. It talks about life and life after basketball and the impact that Len Bias not only had on the University of Maryland, but the impact that he had on society in general. And it gives you, it takes you back in some respects to what it was like at that time, particularly for me as a kid at Maryland and Walt as a high school kid just growing up in the area. And also the things that we went through as pros and our friendship and just sort of how we ended up back at the University of Maryland tutoring guys and bringing them along and helping them avoid some of the things that we had to go through as student athletes while at the same time tutoring them on how to become the best basketball player that they could be. So it's a well-rounded story. It's not just a sports story. It's a family story, and it's an American story.
Right, man. Thanks, man, for even sharing. Like I said, that knowledge, man. I'm pretty sure a lot of people want to know and get the insight, and a lot of especially the athletes and the younger athletes, they need to read this book, man. I think it's very important, man. Hey, Tone, big bro. Man, I appreciate you coming on and taking time out your day, man. I know you have a lot going on, you know. Thanks for just taking the time out your day to join the Go Terpins with Travis Garrison on the Field of 68 Network. I appreciate you, bro. I appreciate everything you ever did for me throughout my career, man. Even now, every time I see you, it's always love. I appreciate you, bro. I just want to let you know that, man. And thanks for everything.
Thank you, man. Thanks for having me, man. And again, brother, you know I always got you right here, man. Under my wing. Under my wing. I got you, man. Anything you need.
I appreciate you, bro, man. And definitely, man, we got to stay in touch, man. And I'm definitely going to be hitting you up from time to time, man. And we're going to link up once, you know, everything gets better, you know. So
yeah, everything starts to open. Get, quote, unquote, get normal again. You keep exactly. on doing your thing, man. Keep on repping us, man. I like what you're doing. Keep doing
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, bro.